Well, that's here. And those online will be doing this approach in the Buddhist path, and we do that by relaxing, generating wisdom and compassion, and taking refuge in the three areas of moments. So we begin to do this by, first of all, being comfortable in doing so. So please get comfortable in your seat. Straighten your back, relax your shoulders, place your hands wherever you like. You can keep your eyes open or close them. When you do feel comfortable, let your body breathe itself. Feeling the body breathe itself. Relax into awareness. And imagine the ground beneath you, made of lapis lazuli, flecked with gold, soft as the palm of a baby's hand. The space above you is filled with rainbows and offerings. And in the space in front of you, on a lion throne, sitting on a cushion of lotus, sun, and moon, is Buddha Shakyamuni. He's surrounded by all the direct and indirect teachers, Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, and the deities, and so forth. You are surrounded by all sentient beings, with your mother sitting beside you on the left, your father beside you on the right. Friends and family are behind you. Difficult people are directly in front of you. And you recollect how fortunate you are to still be alive today. And being alive, you have the leisure and opportunity to attain your spiritual goals. It's important to act right now. Those things do not exist as they seem to. Yet, while things are not quite right, you have met a spiritual friend who is leading you in the safe direction of the three rare sublime ones. You make your offering of practice purely for the benefit of all sentient beings. See yourself as clear as a deity, holding the Vajra bell within a sphere of great bliss. And from this empty, blissful state, join me in saying, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. In response to your refuge prayer, from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectar stream down, and these dissolve into yourself and all living beings surrounding you. Negative karmas and obstructions are purified. Your health and long life are increased, along with your virtues and Dharma realizations. Cleansed by wisdom and love, you recollect the four immeasurable thoughts of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. You decide to develop these yourself and to establish all beings in those four immeasurable states. And so you say, may all sentient beings have happiness in its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering in its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attention for friends and patrons for enemies. In response to your wish, from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectar stream down. And these dissolve into yourself and all living beings surrounding you. Your negative karmas and obstructions are purified. Your health and long life, your virtues and Dharma realizations are increased. And you relax yourself a little more. You prepare to invite the fairy for a two-night mirror. And they appear. And you say, reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, action, and imagine. I declare all my negative actions, accumulated since beginning this time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. So we've purified our body, speech, and mind, and we've accumulated some merit. So that we don't contaminate these with grasping the true existence, we imagine that this merit, our body, the speech, and our mind, is utterly transformed into a pure land. And we offer this to the teacher and the spiritual entourage. And we say, this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents and sun and the moon. I imagine this as the Buddha forever offered. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. The offering has been released and it's been accepted by the Buddha, and he smiles on us with delight. We look up and meet his gaze. And in the eyes of the Buddha, we find immense humility, kindness, and acceptance. Then our own teacher leaves that merit field and comes to the bottom of the crown of your head. He puts his hands together in the prayer mantra. And he asks that inspiring blessings rain down upon yourself and all beings surrounding you, so that all perverse minds quickly come to an end, so that all pure minds are quickly generated, and all outer, inner, and secret obstructions are purified. In response to this prayer, lights and nectar stream down and wash over you and over all the beings surrounding you. All hindrances are purified and you accumulate the merit to become fully enlightened. You now recollect the three principal aspects of the path: renunciation, bodhicitta, and the correct view. And from the heart of the Buddha, infinite life rays fill 10 directions of space, reaching all environments and all beings, who dissolve into light. They are gathered up into the field of merit, which begins to dissolve into the central figure of the Buddha. It now dissolves into the teacher at the crown of your head. He instantly transforms into the aspect of Buddha Shakyamuni. He begins to diminish in size and descend, entering the crown of your head, going down through your body, reaching it at the level of the heart. Everybody's light begins to expand, filling your body, speech, and mind with light. Your mind and the mind of the Guru are now a single entity. And with that clear, spacious awareness, you hear the mantra. join in the same. You hear the bunch of reverberating through space. Now from your heart, rays of light fill the 10 directions of space. And every sentient being abiding within space is utterly transformed. This is a fully awakened state. All differences vanish when you accomplish the two purposes. When you form the 10 directions of space, the light begins to withdraw and re-enter your heart. And you feel your body breathing itself. You can hear different sounds. And you can feel the sleep beneath you. You feel embodied and know that this meditation is one of imagination, whereby the mind has been imprinted with this process. And when these imprints meet the right conditions, you will become enlightened and you will be able to work for others effortlessly and spontaneously. And it's breathing deeply through your nostrils. Exhale through your mouth. Let your eyes flutter open. And move your body in whichever way you want to so that you feel quite at ease and comfortable. This is our third class in this topic. And today we're going to look at the Four Noble Truths, the three forms of suffering, and along with karma and its effects. We're going to begin with sort of giving an overview of the Four Noble Truths, and we'll go into a little bit of depth and look at the three sufferings. So the foundation of the Buddhist teachings, according to His Holiness the Dalai Lama, is the Four Noble Truths, or the Four Truths taught by noble beings. These teachings form the foundation of all the Buddhist teachings, and they provide a framework for understanding both suffering and the liberation from suffering. Basically, it's a spiritual diagnosis and a path to liberation. Four Noble Truths offer a roadmap to understand and overcome suffering. They're like a doctor's diagnosis and treatment plan for the human condition. So the Buddha begins by identifying, like a doctor, the illness called dukkha or suffering. Then he identifies its causes, which are ignorance and craving. And then he tells you, look, liberation is possible. Good health is possible if you take the cure, which is the path. Now, the path is made of basically things that you need to abandon and things that you need to adopt. And the way you abandon and adopt is through using wisdom and compassion. So we have this dualistic approach to Buddhist enlightenment. So it's often said the texts you'll hear teachers say the Buddhist path is like a bird soaring on two wings, and the wings are wisdom and compassion. So just as a bird needs two wings to fly gracefully, the practitioner, people like ourselves, need both wisdom and compassion to progress towards enlightenment. So you might find that when you first come here, you have some sort of suffering of your own. And so you need to, we encourage you to have compassion towards yourself and to find its causes and try to put an end to those causes in the best way you can. This is a quote from His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama, where he says, the four truths of the Aryas, well known as the Four Noble Truths, form the foundation and structure of the Buddhist path. So you're probably all aware there's always these four truths. So the first truth is the truth of dukkha, or the truth of suffering. And then there's the origins. So sometimes when we go along to teachings, they talk about this is the impure side. It's the side that describes the problem and what causes it. And on the other side, they've got what they call the pure side. It's the side where you have a path or a means to get rid of these sufferings. You bring about an end of them. So in brief, the Four Noble Truths are like a compass for the spiritual journey. They guide us through the wilderness of suffering towards the destination of enlightenment. So I've gone very quickly here. Yeah. Any questions? Because we're going to a bit more depth coming up. That's fine. Do you have anything? This is, I could just present the structure of it, the overall view of it. So basically, they're just a guide to understand and put an end to suffering. Of course, the suffering here that they talk about is not just what we normally relate to as physical and mental suffering. The suffering is much deeper. In fact, the Buddha calls it dukkha. They've just been sort of the unsatisfactory conditions that we meet up with in life. There's a way to put an end to that.
And of course, with the Four Noble Truths, it's very easy to dwell on suffering, but it's not so easy to remember, hang on, there's something I can do about this.
Which is pretty strange, isn't it?
It is.
Because in everyday life, we experience suffering, we just go up the road and see the doctor.
Yeah. Well, or not. Not everybody does.
No, most people will try and find help.
Mm. But
very rare to just sit there and keep suffering. Everyone wants a way out.
I certainly have heard non-Buddhists who have an interest in spiritual investigations make that observation that Buddhists are all about suffering.
Yeah, that's true.
So maybe, I mean, I think it's important in the context of how we approach our practice, because that's my main motivation. I don't want to suffer.
Yeah,
but we sort of forget that maybe the path should be emphasized more.
Well, I think there's good reasons for to start off with this way. In fact, there's quite a number of different, well, not a lot of them, but there's a few texts that actually ask why does he do it this way? And of course, in the next section, we'll see that this term suffering has quite a different meaning than what we normally refer to as suffering. But let's do our first meditation. So please, get comfortable. Again, just readjust your posture so your back is straight, your shoulders are relaxed. And close your eyes and take a deep breath. Then exhale slowly and release tension. And let your body relax. Let your mind grow still and arrive fully in this very moment. Now being present, generate an altruistic intention. Our focus will be on the four truths that noble beings realize. These truths are a guide to understanding suffering and being liberated from it. You can imagine holding a map, and on that map is the terrain of life with all its joys and struggles. So these truths are a key to navigating that map, that life. So the first truth realized by noble beings reveals that suffering, birth, aging and loss is part of ordinary life. Acknowledging this truth opens the door to understanding. The second truth identifies craving as the cause of suffering. Like being lost in a maze, desires keep us trapped. But recognizing that offers clarity. We now clearly understand why we are suffering. The third truth known by realized beings assures us that this suffering can come to an end. We can find our way out of the maze. This freedom from the maze is liberation, freedom from craving. So finding the path out of the maze, this brings us to the freedom. The path is the means to become free. So to engage in that path, we need to step onto it and make progress one step at a time. We make progress through these steps through mindfulness and reflection. We have to remember what causes the suffering, what can put an end to it. And we also need to know how do we do that. So decide to put an end to the causes of your own suffering to benefit yourself and all beings. And then breathing in deeply, exhale, and let your eyes flutter open. Okay, so now I'm just going to go have a little in-depth look at these four truths that are known by the noble beings. The first, of course, is called dukkha. And this is the truth of suffering. And what it describes is this sort of unsatisfactory nature of cyclic existence and the aggregates. So the aggregates are the body and mind. The body is called the aggregate of form, and there are four aggregates of mind: feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness. When these five come together, they're called the person. And this person has no control over their lives. They were brought into this cycle of existence as we are, as human beings, through past causes. And they find themselves now inhabiting these five aggregates, which are called the body and mind. Now, this body and mind that we have is subject to pain and anxiety and suffering, old age and sickness, and finally death. And most of this is like out of our control. Now, the second truth known by noble beings is called the origins of dukkha. And these origins are known as the mental afflictions and ignorance. Before I said it was craving, and this is mainly put forward by the Pali tradition, and they put it as the one, but the craving comes out of the ignorance. Craving is a mental affliction. In the Mahayana tradition, we often say it's called karma and affliction. So the karma comes out of the afflictions, and then the afflictions produce more karma. So it's a circular process.
Like a vicious circle.
Yeah, a vicious circle. So we find that these are the causes of suffering. So I put this picture up because they often give the metaphor of gardening in these Four Noble Truths. So it's like the plant itself is like the suffering. We need to find out what is it. So we need to dive into the soil and find the roots of it. And the roots are these karma and affliction. And we've got to sort of uproot those or cut them to find the freedom. which leads us to the third and fourth noble truth, called the cessation of suffering and the path that leads to that cessation. So the cessation is brought about through wisdom realizing emptiness. In the previous slide, we looked at the mental afflictions and ignorance. So ignorance is just a misapprehension of how we exist and how all other phenomena exist. This is good news, because ignorance is just saying we're acting out of a state of unknowing, not knowing something, and then thinking that we're right in what we actually apprehend. This is good, because this can be changed. So these two provide a hope and a method. So if you had found yourself drowning, you wish that you weren't, you say, you don't have to if you know how to swim, or if you have a life jacket. There's some method you can use to prevent the suffering. So the third and fourth are about this, the method and the freedom from the suffering. So our suffering can be eliminated through understanding, this is the wisdom side, and intelligence and practice. And our path will involve developing the wisdom and the positive mental habits that reinforce that wisdom and support it. Now, in terms of dukkha itself, the Buddha taught three types of dukkha. The first is the dukkha of pain. This is the physical and mental suffering that all beings see as undesirable. The second type of dukkha is the dukkha of change, which refers to worldly happiness. This means basically the happiness that our senses provide. And the third type of dukkha is called the pervasive dukkha of conditioning. And this is unique to the Buddha Dharma, and this is the suffering that the Buddha is really getting at in the first noble truth. Without getting rid of this one, the rest will just continue to flourish. So dukkha is a bit like water in three different states. Solid ice is like the pain. Then change is the
water.
The fluid. The pervasive condition is like the vapor. So just as water permeates our world in various forms, suffering permeates our existence in these three ways. My favorite cake. I like it's got three layers too. Pain, change, and conditioning. Conditioning right down the bottom. So dukkha is like a three-layered cake of dissatisfaction. The obvious pain is the frosting. The fleeting pleasures are the middle layers, and our conditioned existence is the foundation.
Is it sometimes called all-pervasive conditionality?
Yes, it is sometimes called all-pervasive conditionality. And the all-pervasiveness means that it pervades the three worlds, the three realms of
desire,
form, and formless.
And conditionality meaning?
The conditions are karma and affliction. They're the conditions that support it. Comes out of those two.
So River says, now I want cake.
Of course
and is. Stacey said, looks good.
Yes, it does look good, doesn't it? It always looks good to me.
Yep, of course it looks good.
That's right. Yeah, so it's funny because Rinpoche used to say that it's very easy to generate renunciation for the suffering of dukkha. Very easy, we can do that. We do this naturally. What we call pain or anxiety states, these obvious states, right? Very easy. It's much more difficult to rid ourselves of the suffering of change and conditionality. So I'm just thinking like this cake there. If you thought that right on top of that layer was something disgusting, you wouldn't eat the cake, would you? And, but So it's the thing.
Like in those Survivor shows.
Yeah. So we'll have a look at each of these. So pain, change, and conditioning. These are the three forms. So, but the suffering that we experience can act as a catalyst to want us to put an end to it. Imagine if you didn't feel physical pain. You know, this is, well, we'd be pretty content, wouldn't we, for most of us. So it's not bad in itself, you might say, because it can lead us to act on it. So reflecting on suffering motivates us to seek a liberation from it and to cultivate compassion. So wanting to be free from that suffering is self-compassion, a renunciation towards your own suffering and its causes. If we don't seek the causes of our suffering and wish to abandon those, it won't be renunciation. When we realize that all beings are just like us, and we want to help them put an end to their suffering too, then we have this greater compassion. The compassion is larger. So suffering is a bit like a wake-up call. It jolts us from complacency and hopefully it will inspire us to embark on a transformative journey towards a state of inner peace and contentment. Again, this takes our wisdom to do it. We need to know what causes the suffering, to be certain that that is the case, and then to be certain that we can stop it. When we take suffering as a catalyst, you can sort of like embrace it as an opportunity for change. When we engage in the spiritual path, there's basically two ways we engage in it. We do it for ourselves primarily, or we do it primarily for others. Usually we start with ourselves, but then over time we'll shift and see others are in the same state as we are. There are more of others than there are of oneself. So let's do it for others, and I'm included in that. Now, if you wish to achieve to get rid of all the causes of your suffering and to develop all of your good qualities to be of benefit to others, we call this the mind of bodhicitta, a mind that seeks enlightenment for the benefit of others. If you could generate that mind, then all negativities become workable for you. You see it as being very, very useful. So this is like, I don't know whether they still do it nowadays, they probably don't, but before the Second World War in Japan, what people used to do was they'd take their feces outside and they'd put them in the garden. They used to call it night soil. And in most other countries, they just throw it away. It was disgusting. Get rid of it. The Japanese used to put their garden and they'd grow their flowers and their vegetables out of it. The bodhisattva attitude is like that. It says, give me the disgusting stuff. It's workable. My own disturbing emotions that we just wanted to get rid of, I can work with those to benefit myself and others.
It's like Venerable Rabina saying, goody, it's like compost.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So the bodhisattvas transform their adversity into opportunities for spiritual growth. So we can do this ourselves, or we could train ourselves in doing it. So I'll suggest an example, right? So if you have been challenged recently by something, like so, for instance, there is a cyclone approaching.
There's an adversity. Yeah,
there is an adversity, so we're all going to be challenged to meet it. So what might be three positive outcomes or lessons learned from facing a cyclone?
I've reached out to our neighbours, and including our neighbour that we had
a really difficult
relationship with, and had really positive responses. So it's been several years since we've communicated in a positive way, and now this is creating harmony.
Yeah, so it's pretty amazing, wasn't it, I think?
Yeah.
So you're going to just put that into a sort of more common language. So if you, so basically, you sent an email, didn't you, or a text message? If you send a text to say, there's a cyclone coming, if anything happens to you, let us know immediately so we can help.
Yeah.
So then she wrote back and said, I'm going off down to the shops. Is there anything I can get you? Isn't it? Just like that. So this has never happened before. It's the first time it's ever happened. But I came out as facing this differently. That suddenly we found greater harmony. So we can all do things like this. And this is what the Bodhisattva does, is what we call thought transformation. You take a difficulty, you approach it in a different way, in a helpful way. And it often comes about by saying, you look at your own difficulties and realize other people that go through them too. What can I do to help you? So here I like what Lama Yeshe says. He says, I hope you understand what you mean by spiritual. What I mean by spiritual is mental. So you change your way of thinking. Suffering helps us change our thinking.
I certainly think now I'm much more patient by recognising other people are probably suffering.
So patience is almost like a byproduct of recognising other people are suffering.
So just to sum it up in terms of these Four Noble Truths. So recognising suffering is like realising that your house has a leaky roof. We might have one. But it's like knowing that this problem, right, can we repair it or do something to not make it so bad? So it's the same over here. You recognise, most of all, is to recognise suffering at its deeper levels, which is very easy to do at the first level. It's the second and third that are much more difficult. Recognize that there's problems and you can do something about them.
But that's so,
do something about
so
it.
Funny, because even with the cyclone, there's so many people are like, oh, it'll be okay, don't worry. Which is, it's okay until it's not okay.
Yeah, that's just what we do, isn't it?
It is what we do, yeah. It's
so, so the Buddha goes against what we normally do, the Dharma goes against what we normally do. In fact, Dharma's often said, the teachings that go against the stream of ordinary repetitive behaviour.
But again, we have things pretty easy here. So I do often reflect on the challenges that people have, say Palestine or war or zones. Obviously, they have a lot more problems than we do. You know, they really have.
Which gives them more impetus to actually work against them.
Yeah.
Okay, let's do our next meditation. So again, just get comfortable in your seat. Feel the support of your seat. And just let your breath flow naturally. Feel the body breathe itself. Relax into the awareness. Then create an altruistic intention for the meditation. If I wish to experience and understand the nature of suffering, so I can put an end to it for myself and all beings. So the Buddha taught that suffering arises in three distinct forms. There are the inevitable pains of life. There's the fleeting nature of pleasure. And there's a subtle dissatisfaction underlying existence. So recognizing these three forms of suffering should not lead to despair, but to empowerment. It reveals that there is a path to freedom. Acknowledging these three forms of suffering is like discovering a leaky roof in your home. It's only by noticing it can you repair it. And that way, creating a safe and comfortable space. But why do we resist acknowledging suffering? Perhaps it seems overwhelming, or maybe it's just uncomfortable. Yet ignoring it only deepens the damage. Facing it allows us to begin healing. So what might happen if we were to accept the existence of suffering? Well, we might ask, why? Or how does it take place? What's causing it? This leads to insight into the causes of suffering. Accepting that suffering actually takes place gives us insight into its causes and helps us learn how to address them with wisdom and compassion. So how does understanding suffering connect us with others? So realizing suffering, that everyone faces their own struggles, fosters empathy and kindness, stirs within us a sense of, I want to help. Addressing suffering, addressing what we call dukkha, requires effort. We need the tools of mindfulness and ethical living and wisdom. Decide to carry these tools with you wherever you go. Mindfulness means remembering what suffering is, how it exists, that it has causes, that you can do something about it. It requires a sense of ethical living so you do not recreate the causes of suffering. And wisdom, know that you know you can do something about it. Let us carry this awareness into the remainder of the evening and over the weekend when we will be facing a cyclone. Look at how your mind responds to these difficulties. Try to bring awareness, mindfulness, wisdom into your behavior. And then out, breathing in deeply. Exhale, put your eyes back open. So now we're going to have a little talk about what we call karma. So karma is a subset of cause and effect. And karma, when Buddhism was first, when it was first taught and understood and then presented through the different tenet systems of understanding, Karma was first thought of like an action, but the actions are mainly around what you did physically and what you did with your voice. The further development was like what the mind does. So it brings us to our presentation where karma is basically intention, intended actions. These actions may be of a mental or physical or verbal type. So karma connects our thoughts, our words and our actions to our experiences. It's very much like a natural law. In that good actions lead to positive outcomes while harmful actions bring about suffering. When you understand this, this empowers us to shape our own lives consciously. By making ethical choices, we create patterns that lead to happiness in the present and future. It also helps us avoid suffering in the present and the future. So karma basically links our actions to our experiences. It helps you guide, as a guide to your own journey through life. So karma shapes our destiny through precise cause and effect relationships. So karma is like a garden where our actions are the seeds. The thoughts we plant and nurture grow into the flowers or the weeds of our life experiences. By understanding karma, we can empower ourselves to make better choices.
Funny, for so much of my life I've been so resistant about gardening because, you know, you need patience and you need to pay attention and all of those things, but actually it's a really good thing to pay attention to this, like, karma gardening.
Yes, as I see, karma connects our actions to their consequences. The weight of these consequences and the weight of the deed depends on factors like intention, how often you do it, and whether you actually counteract it in terms of, well, it could be in terms of either good karma or bad karma. So actions involving spiritual teachers or altruistic individuals or your parents carry heightened potency. So through understanding the intricacies of karma, this understanding can help us guide us towards making wiser choices in life. So I put this picture of the spider web up because, you know, I put this up too, like, karmic effects ripple through multiple dimensions with varying intensity. Meaning they carry it through multiple lives. And an action done today may have a consequence 20 years later or lifetimes later. So I know myself, I've done actions that haven't borne their consequences yet. And I'm praying they don't. So I've done as much as I possibly can. So in other words, it does not follow that because you do something unskillful, hurt somebody or, you know, a situation, it doesn't follow that you must experience the karmic consequence of it. Because something can be done. If you don't do something about it, you will experience the consequence. This is a bit like being in a courthouse. You've committed some sort of crime or, you know, you've done something wrong. And you're standing before the judge, and the judge says something like, the prisoner has shown, or the defendant has shown no remorse. So they give you a really heavy sentence, right? But if you're smart about this and sort of authentic about it, you might realise, oh man, I did a really terrible thing, I'm so sorry. And you are in the box and you say to the families or and the judge, you know, I was wrong with what I did, I'm so sorry. You know, if there's any way I can make recompense, well, let me do that. And, you know, so forth. You know, you explain the situation and let them know you're sorry. You know, often, of course, the judges look at you and the jurors look at you and go,
yeah,
you get a different sentence.
And you've already suffered so much with that.
Yeah, and you're saying, yeah, I've suffered a great deal and I know I was wrong. I'm so Sorry. In fact, in New Zealand, I was doing this, weren't they? They get the youth and they put them up there and they get up to the court and then they bring up the people you've hurt and you say, your actions, this is what they did to me. And some of you see, oh my gosh.
Restorative justice.
Restorative justice, it's saying this is right, right? So then you, the point is to for the defendant to realise you've created a lot of harm here.
Yeah, you created a fellow human being and probably had no idea, weren't thinking about them at all at the time.
But I mean, I'm sure that most of this teenage crime, stealing cars and walking around with machetes and things like that, they have no thought of the consequences.
No, that's right. They have no idea of the consequences of these crimes.
They're not thinking about it at all.
Yeah. So it comes like to some vast, intricate spider web where each thread represents an action. You know, unless you know those spider webs, you can pull the web way out here and it goes all the way down there and the spider comes out. He goes, ooh, did it tie. No matter when you're right down very close to the spider or far away, but you know, it's a consequence coming. Yeah, so we need to be, we can say there are consequences for our actions. Mental, physical and verbal. So we need to be careful. And when we found that we've done unskillful things, best thing you can do is acknowledge it. And you know, we know that there's the four behaviours you can do, you know, to say, I won't do this again, make a promise of some sort, make recompense in some way. That way the effect won't be as harsh as it would be if you didn't. Another quote from His Holiness, he says, so thinking in this way, means negative activities create negative results, positive activities, positive results. Thinking in this way allows us to realize our anger, allows us to release our anger and the sense of injustice and accept the situation. Doing this transforms a bad situation into a learning experience because we understand that if we do not like suffering results, we should abandon creating their causes in the future. So this is the one good thing about, you know, experiencing suffering yourself. We must realize sometime or other I've created the cause for this effect. This is, you know, created by me. Saying that, it's very important to understand who the me is. Right? Otherwise you start blaming this person here, the person in this life, and you look back at what did I do to experience that?
You deserve this.
Right? And that doesn't make sense. It's important to understand, use your wisdom, your intelligence, to realize how phenomena exist. So karma transforms difficulties into opportunities for growth and wisdom. And the metaphor they often use is the gardening one, where a garden, karma is like a garden where our thoughts, words and actions are seeds. The fruits we harvest depend upon what type of seed we plant and nurture. So briefly, our actions shape our experiences, both positive and negative, and accepting difficult situations can lead to personal growth and wisdom. I've certainly discovered that, is the case.
You remember emptiness, you know, you don't have to, you don't have any territory that you've got to defend. Instead of saying, yes, but I didn't mean to, I was young at the time, I had a lot going on, which is all sort of valid, but remembering emptiness, you know, that you've actually haven't got to protect the I, but they're accusing, it gives you the capacity to say, you're right, I did do that.
Sure, that's right.
And then, in turn, what they do is they just become very forgiving because you're not counteracting a, you know, like an accusation.
Because you're not being defensive.
You're not being defensive. Yeah, it's like a magic formula. Yes.
So, Eddie, what's the difference between, so you're talking about karmic actions and we've got karmic actions of the mind. So what's the difference between an activity of the mind and, say, just a dissatisfied state of mind, like an emotion? What's the difference between the two?
You've got a dissatisfied state of mind.
Yeah, and you're talking about karma as like an activity of the mind. So what's the action?
Well,
and what's the difference between that and just an emotion?
I don't know. I can't answer that right now. I'd have to think.
You know, like you have an emotion, like you dislike something or you dislike somebody. Ooh, I don't like them.
Yeah, we're just thinking, like, you know, use the word emotion. So there's no word for emotion in Buddhist psychology. So you're bringing two different things in here.
Feeling, then.
Okay, so you have a feeling. Every feeling is karma. It's an outcome of a karma.
It's an outcome, but you said, so what's the difference between a feeling, which is an outcome of a karma, and a mental activity?
Okay, so we can talk about karma here in terms of cause and in terms of effect. So that's what we've got to ask ourselves. Are we talking about karma in terms of effects, or are we talking about in terms of causes?
Yeah, so what's the difference in your mind?
Well, causes come before effects.
Give me an example, like...
Well, you can't have a plant without a seed, right? Well, this is the physical example. So you're not going to have dissatisfaction unless you've got the seed of dissatisfaction in your mind before you are dissatisfied.
But is having dissatisfaction a mental action of karma?
You can look at it, like I said again, you can be an outcome or it could be a cause. It depends, what's going to follow from your dissatisfaction?
Maybe nothing.
Well then, it's an effect. It doesn't cause anything else because nothing's going to follow. So it's going to come from some previous moment of it. It's an effect, and you don't create any more dissatisfaction because nothing's going to follow.
So it's neutralized.
Yeah, and you can easily neutralize it by just staring straight at it, by bringing awareness to it. So nothing follows from it. It crumbles underneath your awareness. So no more is created. So that's just an effect that comes to an end. It's like they say, oh, it's fine, yeah, because that karma has come to an end. You do not create any new karma from it. So this is an effect from a previous cause. Oh, if you have this dissatisfaction and now something else comes from it, you can say this dissatisfaction could be a cause for new problems or a condition for something else. Because we often behave quite badly when we're dissatisfied, don't we? So this dissatisfaction can act as a condition for something else.
But what's the mental activity?
That's karma, the activity. That's the action that takes place. That's what I'm saying, is it, what's the action that's going to take place?
Yeah, what's the mental action?
Well, I don't know, what is it?
Because you can see, you can tell if you're speaking that's a verbal action or physically, but what's a mental action? Like, say, you've got a dissatisfied feeling as a result. What's that, the cause? What would be an action?
Are you talking about the action of what? Cause or effect?
Cause.
Well, it's something of a similar type nature. You only get, that's how it works. What type of, many people that are dissatisfied go, have you been dissatisfied in the past? Yeah, heck yeah. Well, there you have your causes. Similar type behaviours. Remember with karma we have similar types of behaviour, similar types of... there are four different types of effect that we could look at here. So what is it, the rebirth effect? No, because you're already a human being, so you count that one out. Environmental effect? No, count that one out. So all we've got left now is behavioural and experiential.
So River says here, so mental action would be, that be something like planning revenge?
Yep, that would be one, sure. So so the two major ones here would be a behaviour of similar type. Oh, what was the other one I said before? Behaviour and...
Experience. Experience.
An experience, thank you. It's an experiential effect of similar type or a behaviour of similar type? We talk about the action.
Mm. So that's a result and a cause.
Yeah, that's right. So something that's right. So as I was saying before, if you stare right at it with awareness, there's not going to be any cause. The effect comes to an end. But whether you have the, if you don't, this effect can lead to the new cause.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So really these seeds are cause and effect depend upon which direction you're coming at. They can't be both at the same time, but they can be one or the other, depend upon the approach. Are absorbed by the feeling, then you're in trouble. Yeah, and you'll be a lot of activity if you get absorbed by your mental afflictions, right? You'll either create more of them mentally or usually you'll start to speak or behave. Again, we've got the behavioural effect or we've got similar mental effects. Okay, so let's really near at the end. So as you probably know, karma is a massive topic. These four effects are very good to become familiar with. They're the rebirth effect. What do they call it? The
fully ripened.
A fully ripened effect, often known as the rebirth effect. So that's one. So you look at us and go, no, that's already taking place. That can't be. In terms of the environment, no. So we've only got these two left.
The experience and
the behaviour.
And the behaviour.
Yeah.
But so with the mental action of karma, you know, creating mental karma instead of, you know, physical or speech, it's when you're absorbed in it. Is that so
because at each moment of mind you're creating more of an answer. By staying in it.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out what's the difference between experiencing it, like having it wash over you till it comes to its natural end, or being absorbed in it.
Well, you've had that experience, haven't you?
I'm trying to figure out what the difference between the two is.
I think anybody who's had that experience will know. But you're telling me you can't tell the difference between when you're actually absorbed in a mental affliction and when...
When it's just like an arising feeling that's washing over you and you're not getting involved in it. But it's still an experience, ripening experience.
Yeah, and then it finishes, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And then
eventually.
Of course, it's got to take its own momentum.
Yeah.
And so what you try and do is, like you say, you use mindfulness, you have all these different techniques, or you can cut it off immediately, as quickly as you can, using a Dharma technique. So that's got to be discernible experientially. If you don't, it's like saying I can't tell the difference when I'm not suffering and when I am.
Mm.
That's what I hear you say. Mm.
Yeah, so what's the difference between recognizing the suffering or being absorbed in the suffering?
Well, when you're absorbed, you don't recognize it as suffering. Yep, so you're despairing, okay? Yes.
And, if you don't recognize it, I'm experiencing despair, and then counteract it,
So we don't do that.
So if you just be unconsciously just
just stay on despair, Sandy. So either you recognize you're despairing and say, okay, this is despair, you bring cognitive awareness to it, and just even recognizing it changes it immediately. You don't have the same normal response, right? Then the other is you don't recognize it.
You don't recognize it.
No, and you're absorbed in your sense of despair.
Yes.
But that's the activity of despair. Yes.
So that's the key, being absorbed in it.
Yeah, and it goes from moment to moment to moment. You feed it through your unawareness of it.
Yes.
Stefan says, doesn't that ripening experience turn into a cause depending on how we respond to it.
Yes. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So these phenomena don't exist inherently. They're dependent. So you have to look at how you're coming at this. Right? So from one direction, it's going to be like this. From the other, it's not. And so if you come at it from the experience or from the behavior, they're two different phenomena, aren't they? And you have to realize when we talk about this, it's moments. So each moment is a moment of mind, of this seed with its potential. What's happening in the moments? And again, another thing you might need to think of is that, I don't know whether you're aware of this or not, by drilling down like this, I would suggest you're looking for inherent karma. You're looking for something real. But all we can do is describe this phenomena.
Now I'm just trying to pinpoint what the difference, because right at the beginning how you said mostly with the Mahayana it's about mental activity, the mind,
yeah,
rather than the speech or the action. So what I'm trying to, from an experiential point of view, figure out what's the difference between an experience and an activity.
Oh, okay. So this is quite straightforward. So I have the experience that I dislike you and I slap you in the face. That's the activity.
But that's a physical activity. Yeah, what's a mental activity, though?
Because the mental activity leads to the physical and the verbal.
I don't get it. Because that's... So you have an experience of not liking someone. That's an experience.
Yeah.
And then you have an action of slapping them. But what's the mental activity after the experience?
I'm going to slap you.
A thought. I'm going to slap you. A thought.
It might not even be a thought, but they're going from here to there.
Yeah, I don't get where the mental activity is.
What do you think? The mind just stopped?
No, it just went to a physical action. Like,
where was the mind as you engage physically?
Is it sort of dwelling on anger? Is it motivated by anger?
The mind's always present, right?
Yeah.
That's the activity of mind.
Just being.
Of course it is. Any of these moments of mind that you're having can be interrupted at any time, can't they? If they're not interrupted, they keep going at a similar time. That's the activity. One moment to the next moment to the next moment to the moment. That's the activity. Yeah, either you're mentally interrupted.
You're mentally interrupted. You realise, oh, I'm feeling really angry. And then
you change your mind.
You change your mind,
right? That's the whole idea of having... you can change your mind in those three different ways.
So it even says mental activity, such as engaging with a thought, is still a unit of behaviour, and all behaviour has consequences?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. It goes more of the same until either it runs out of its energy or you interrupt it in some way. Because with these negative states, they don't just keep going. And so calmness is like... One of the expressions of karma is like a sort of impulse.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it goes from moments of mind. But the impulse doesn't go on like forever, as we all know.
So right. Could you have an experience of disliking someone, but your impulse is to refrain from harm?
Yep. You could also have the impulse that you don't like someone, and that impulse could lead to hatred. So there's a mental, there's karmic activity of going from one state to the next of a similar type. So when the author talk about karma, this is why it's so important to use metaphors and analogies like plants that grow moment by moment by moment and keep the similar type. But there's change taking place, isn't there? You've got to take those ideas and move them to your mental activity. And know that in terms of the mental activity that goes this particular way, but it can also come out as verbal and physical behavior. So verbal and physical behavior is quite simple. Right? Yeah, okay, that's right, your line is the mind's driving. But then when you look at the mind, what are you going to find? You're not going to find anything, you're just going to find descriptions. Which karma is a description of mental activity, mental impulses. There's nothing more behind it than that. Then you're going to look at it from, you know, which aspect are you going to look at it? And all of these are descriptions. But you know, there's a description of some sort of mental event, you might say. So that mental event is called a karma. So the result, or it's going to cause, or it's a cause. But that cause and effect depend upon which way you're looking at it. But they're not the same at the same time. You cannot have a cause and effect that are one and the same thing. But you can look at that phenomenon. If you look at it, you sort of hold to it and go, okay, that's this moment that I'm looking at. Now, how am I looking at it? So I did this with plants, right? The simple, like I said, the simplest way to do this, to see how you can be grasping at the inherent existence of the phenomenon you're trying to describe, or not, or catch yourself doing it, right? So if you look at a plant, right, you look at a leaf, ask yourself, is that a cause or an effect? It's the same thing with the mind, right? You just turn around and go, okay, take that moment of mind, is it a cause or an effect? Yeah, that's right, but not at the same time. But not at the same time, that's right. So it's the same with mind. You take any of these disturbing emotions and ask about this, well, it depends. Okay, good meditation. Okay, so again, we just sit comfortably, get your eyes closed. Maybe just take a deep breath in and then exhale. And let your lungs fill up. And then let your body breathe itself. And then just reflect on this. That every thought, word, or deed is a seed planted in the garden of your life. So what kind of garden do you want to cultivate? So karma connects our actions to outcomes. It's the shaping of our experience. Like gravity, it operates with precision. It might inspire us to act with mindfulness and care. So try to imagine karma to be like a garden where every action is a seed. These seeds bloom into joy or grow into weeds of suffering. So what happens when we plant seeds of anger or resentment? Well, they grow into weeds that choke our joy. But what would happen if we planted seeds of love or generosity? Well, a different, more vibrant garden emerges. So you can ask yourself, what seeds have we planted today? perhaps there are acts of kindness, perhaps there are moments of frustration. So what weeds have we allowed to grow? Can acknowledge them without any sort of judgment, any sort of moral judgment. But how can we nurture the garden to move forward? Can you imagine tending the karmic garden with patience and care? So imagine doing that, and then carry the awareness into this evening and into tomorrow. And just remember that every moment is an opportunity to either plant seeds of joy or seeds of resentment, frustration, and so forth. And then breathing in, exhale. So in terms of karma, the most important thing you remember about karma is, like I said, so we've got karma of cause, karma of result. Most times we work out karmas, we have to look at the result, and then we track it back for the cause. But there's also, as I said, the karma of intention or intended effect, which is the most important one. This is the one we can actually consciously generate. And this is what we mean by motivation. So motivation, or this sort of intended action, these are the ones that we give great strength to. Many times stuff that just arises doesn't have much strength. But this sort of thing, where you intend to act in a particular way, you make the karma very strong. So it's very important to try to be very clear about why we're practicing. We can always, in fact, you know, it's often said in the text, two most important moments of any meditation is what you do at the beginning and what you do at the end. In the middle, it's always messy for us at least. So, but at the end, the beginning, we can get that right. So we can always create at least some positive, strong calmness there.
Just read that.
So here I'm saying that your actions are the pen. We're writing our future with our actions. And this future is a blank page, which is basically your own mind. Completely open, anything can take place in there. We want to, not to say anything can, but if we're much more careful, like being a really good writer or author, we can decide what's going to go into the mind. And with an understanding of karma, know what the likely outcomes of that are. So to do this, we just sort of challenge ourselves, I guess, to be the best type of people we can be, to write our futures with deliberation. Next week, we're going to be looking at what we call the ultimate nature, which of course is the emptiness of inherent existence. Its flip side called dependent arising, and how you can bring these two together and produce what are called cessations. So the cessations are just the absences of different forms of suffering. So we'll look at that next week. And we can take our questions, our discussions, our meditations, our listings, set them in the direction of enlightenment. So let's do that now, create a positive karma. So okay, I want to dedicate whatever I've created here tonight towards enlightenment, knowing that my actions, myself and enlightenment, have no intrinsic existence whatsoever, therefore it's possible to bring it about. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the Supreme Jewel, Bodhi Chitta, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. And as long as space endures, as long as sentient beings abide, may I too remain to the stars as so is of the world. The wish-granting, wish-fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world. To the incomparably kind Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech. May all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And finally, in holding and spreading the Buddha's precious and complete teachings through exploration and practice, you wore the armor of patience that has never discouraged. Incomparable, venerable Guru, to you, I make this request. Okay, thank you, folks here. Thank you, online.